Take me where the promises are real.
Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim R., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NABA Zoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NABA Zoom room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org desperately in need will hear tonight's speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. The first time I heard our speaker at the podium, she had another problem that wasn't alcoholism. She was fighting cancer, and she succeeded. It was a very spiritual moment for me, and I didn't know I would have cancer soon, but her story really helped me through the trials that I had to go through. And like her, I've stayed sober all these years, too, and Carrie's one of the reasons. So here she is, Carrie J.
Hey, buddy. My name's Carrie, and I'm an alcoholic. Tim, thank you. You're going to make me cry. That was so sweet. We do have a special bond. My name's Carrie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I just want to start by saying that I have a home group that is the Deaf Sober Group of AA. We meet in Atlanta, Georgia at the NABA Club. And I'll explain more about that later, why I'm a non-deaf person who's been going to a deaf meeting for 25 years. I have a sponsor, and she has a sponsor. And I have a sobriety date, which is October 3rd, 1994. I have a service position in my home group. And all these things are very important to my sobriety. Telling my story is not the most favorite thing for me. But I realized I have to just get over myself. It's not about me. And I asked for God to help me to be a channel to hopefully give a message that people can identify with. You know, I'm just here to share my experience, strength, and hope. I'm just another alcoholic. It's basically the deal. You know, like I said, I'm a little nervous, but I figure as long as I don't fall down or fall out of my chair, throw up, or pass out, then it is successful. And, you know, I did enough of that when I was drinking. I don't have to do that anymore. So I'll tell you, first of all, because I know when I go to these meetings, I always try to figure out how old the person is. I'm trying to figure out, oh, okay, they got sober when they were 12, and they've been sober 26 years, and then, but they got married, and then they did, and I'm doing it all in my head. So I was born March 25th, 1966. So I'm 55 years old. And I got sober when I was 28. Is that right? Yeah, I'm coming up on my 26th year sober. That amazes me. You know, I've been sober longer than I drank, which is pretty amazing. So I was born in Kansas City, Missouri, and we moved around a lot until I was about 5 years old. And then we settled in Miami. So I grew up in Miami, Florida. I was there, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, and there was a lot going on down there. There was a lot of drugs coming in. There was a lot of violence. It was Miami Vice and all that stuff, and it was an exciting time. It was also a cool place to grow up because we had the beach, we had the wonderful weather. For me, what was really interesting is how multicultural Miami is. People from all over, mostly the Caribbean, people from a lot of other places, a lot of different cultures and languages, and I've always been really interested in that. I went to public school, went to public high school. I decided that because of my love of languages that I would learn German because there were so many people in Miami that already spoke Spanish as their first language. I would never be able to compete with that. So I just decided I would learn German, and my dad had been in the service in Germany before I was born, so that kind of spurred my interest. And in high school, I was involved with a German club, and that involved drinking. We drank a lot of beer. The drinking age back then was 18, and then they were moving it up during that time. I'm not exactly sure of when, because I started drinking when I was 15. They were trying to get the drinking age to 21 throughout the country. So, but we were grandfathered in. Those of us who had already been 18 were allowed to keep drinking, and so I did. But I got ahead of myself a little bit. I started drinking when I was 15 in earnest. I mean, I had drank before that. My first memory of drinking and getting drunk was when I was 13. And I went to a party. We had some British exchange students at our junior high. I guess I was in junior high. And they came over. So there's a big party, and older kids were there. They were like, you know, the 18-year-olds. And they were able to go and buy beer. So that was a big deal. I got really drunk and, you know, threw up, fell down. I was always hurting myself. I was just not a graceful drunk. I was a blackout drinker, and I was a binge drinker. And I drank because I wanted to change the way I felt. I never really felt like I fit in. I had low self-esteem and all these things. So I figured that drinking would solve my problems. And for a while, it made me feel good. Until I woke up with a terrible hangover, and people would tell me what I'd done the night before. And I didn't usually remember. So that was, I always laughed it off. Like, oh, I really did that. And sometimes it would involve getting thrown in the pool or throwing other people in the pool. Because there were a lot of pool parties in Miami. And I was a little scrawny thing. But my motto was, well, if I can't remember it, I must have had fun. So blacking out was part of my story. And now I've heard other women who've also been blackout drinkers. And, you know, I was very lucky not to have a lot more terrible things happen to me. You know, when you're just not there, anything can really happen. And I remember one time later, I was drinking in Virginia Highlands after I moved up here. And I was at Atkins Park. We were drinking pitchers of beer, and somebody said, well, Carrie, you just disappeared, and we saw you walking along outside on the sidewalk trying to get a cigarette, and we didn't know you smoked. And I was like, well, I don't unless I'm drunk. That was kind of funny. Like, where's Carrie? I don't know. That happened a lot. So I drank through high school. I went to college. I came to college up here, and because of my interest in international things, I got involved with the international dorm and lived there, and I still have some of my best friends were in that dorm, people from all over. So I feel like I'm skipping a lot of important stuff, but my drinking career was what it was, and, you know, I drank a lot. Immediately after, or during and after my last year of college, I got involved with in a relationship with a man I affectionately called the man from hell. It was the one-night stand that turned into a three-year relationship. He was a violent drunk. He was abusive, but he would beat me up even if he hadn't been drinking. So he used me as a punching bag, and I didn't really know any different. I just thought, well, I must have done something to upset him or whatever. And I learned now that no one should put up with that. And, you know, it's part of my story, and I try to tell men or women, you know. If you're in a situation where someone's hurting you, you don't need to put up with that. I drank a lot to cover that up. A lot of drinking involved in that relationship. And I did get out. And I escaped. And I came up to... See, I was living in South Florida again at that time. And I got in the car and I just drove to Atlanta. First, I went to my parents' house. And I cannot even imagine their horror at seeing me again, you know, with black eyes on my face, just, you know, chunks of my hair had been pulled out. It was really awful. My face was just totally swollen up. I stayed there for a while, but I was afraid he was going to come after me and find me there, so I came up to Atlanta. And so I've been here ever since, and that was in 1990. You know, the drinking continued. It was just getting a little different because I knew I couldn't really drink socially and be around people. I just couldn't, like, be around people. So I drank a lot in, I was living in a little attic apartment. I already knew that I should not be driving once I started drinking, because it's like they say in the Big Book, once I start, I cannot stop. And I just knew that it was not good. And I was also kind of afraid to drink with people outside in bars, because I didn't really know what would happen. It was getting to be dangerous. So then I was drinking by myself, very isolated and lonely. I thought I came upon an answer that I would go see a counselor because I was so miserable. You know, my life just really is sucky. And if I could get a different job, a different relationship, get a better relationship with my family, then everything would be better. And about the second time I went there, she said, "I want you to go to AA." I said, "Whoa, wait a minute. Like, I work at night. I work weekends. I don't have time to go to these meetings." And she handed me a book. It was a schedule book. We used to have printed schedule books. And she handed it to me and said, "I want you to go to 2 AA meetings this week." And so, "Oh, I don't know about that. You know, I just don't know how I can fit it in my busy schedule." Of course, you know, I would work. I was working second or third shift. I don't know. I'd work like 5 p.m. to 2 a.m. And then I'd stay up drinking after I got home until it got light. And then I'd pass out and barely wake up in time to make it to work at 5 in the afternoon. But I had such a busy schedule that I just didn't know. But I did go to my first meeting, and this is a funny story, because I looked it up in that book she gave me, and I thought, well, you know, get off work at some ungodly hour, 2 or 3 in the morning, I can maybe go to a meeting at noon, that'll work. And I found one near where I was living. Since I've been in Atlanta, I've lived near Grant Park, actually in Ormwood Park, and it was in Midtown, and it was called the Galano Club. And I thought, okay, that's like Gallo, and those Gallo guys made wine. I don't know why I thought Galano was like Italian for wine. I just didn't know anything. And I showed up because she suggested that I should go to this meeting. And I showed up and they had just moved. They had changed buildings. And I got there. And I was so proud that I got there. You know, to be somewhere at noon was a big deal. And there was nobody there. And I saw a little thing on the mailbox saying they'd moved. But I went to the payphone because we didn't have cell phones. And I called the central office, and I was, like, near hysterics. I said, "Listen, I'm here at this meeting. I'm here for the first time ever, and there's nobody here, and I don't know what to do." And she's like, "Well, can you wait and go later today?" I said, "No, this is it. And then I went over there, and I saw on their mail drop that it had moved, and I drove over there to the new place, and I got there so late, and I didn't know what was going on. And I heard people sharing. I couldn't necessarily identify, but I stayed, and I kind of thought it was like church when they passed the basket, and I was trying to put money in, and they said, "No, you're new, you don't have to put money in." And so afterwards, people said, "Keep coming back." And I said, "Listen, I'm straight, and it seems like this is a gay meeting. Is it okay if I'm here?" And they said, "Listen, if you have a desire to stop drinking, you belong in AA. You know, you can certainly keep coming back." So that was my first experience at an AA meeting. It was pretty funny. And I went back there, I guess it was to get my 10-year chip. I went back there. And later I ended up going to that meeting on a regular basis with some of the folks I know through the deaf meeting and the deaf sober meeting for the Saturday night speaker meeting. And I scheduled the interpreters for that meeting. And that was a lot of fun. I talked about what it was like. I'm talking about what happened. I skipped over some of the stuff, like ending up in the hospital in a blackout and having stitches in my head. And then I was walking around campus the next day, and a doctor said, "Oh, how are you doing?" I had no memory that this person had stitched me up. I didn't even think they used anesthetic because I was so out of it. And they said, "Carrie, you were like fighting and cursing, and it was awful." And that's how I get when I drink. So I'm really fortunate that I don't have to behave like that anymore. Something happened at those first few meetings. I came and I was, you know, really nervous. I didn't necessarily know if it was going to work for me. The second meeting I came to, I found the 130 group at NABA. 130 was a little easier. It was a little more palatable than noon. It was easier for me to get somewhere at 130 in the afternoon. And so it was a Think It Through Sober group. And they met 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. And then on Saturday and Sunday, there was a 2:00 beginners meeting. So I went there a lot. I do remember the first time somebody asked me to do one of the readings, I was terrified. I said, "No, I can't do that. It's too much responsibility." And I would go in, I would sit I would sit at the wall and didn't really want anyone to see me. I was listening to what they were saying, and I saw people who were not miserable. I saw people who were laughing, people who were supposedly, it seemed to me, they were wholesome members of society. Although a lot of people at the 130 meeting didn't necessarily have regular jobs. It was kind of a transient meeting. You know, there were some people like me who did shift work, and I worked in the afternoons. There were some people who were retired. And there were some people who just were kind of new. And there was one guy who was proudly unemployed for many years, and he had a long time sober. And he was one of the first people I met out there at NABA Club, and I still see him. And he had, oh, man, I think he had like 10 or 15 years then, and I just thought that was amazing. I went to the meetings, and I listened, and they drew me out of my shell. There was a guy named Jack, and he's passed away now, but he would, for some reason, he ended up chairing the meeting, like, almost every day, and he turned out he was the coffee guy, he was the treasurer, he was everything. He was, and so I didn't know how this thing worked, and I found out later, wow, you're supposed to have spirit of rotation in a healthy group, but I guess nobody wanted to kick him out. So he would call on me to do a reading or to share in the open discussion meeting. And I got a resentment against this guy. I thought, he's picking on me. I really got a complex about that. And I realized after a while that he was just trying to draw me out of my shell. And I needed that. You know, I could have easily sat there against the wall and become part of the paneling and just ease my way out of AA. I needed to feel like I was part of the group. And they enabled me to do that. So at first, I think one of the first things I did was I became the coffee person, and I don't drink coffee at all. I can't stand it. But they said, okay, you're in charge of making the coffee. So I would go and get just a lot of coffee supplies. I carried around the 1,500 cups in my trunk, and I get the 5-pound bags of sugar when they were buy one, get one free at Publix, and I was ready, man. Like, I had this coffee thing down. And then I was worried one time because I couldn't get there. I think my car broke down. I was still driving the drunk car, right? And it didn't always run. Like, oh, man, I can't get there. What are they going to do? They're not going to have any coffee. And someone said to me, Carrie, it's okay. The meeting will go on without any coffee. So that was very important for me to have a service position. And I went on to become very active in service. I became the GSR of that group. I've been the GSR of a couple different groups. I've been treasurer, But one of the best things, I'm getting ahead of myself too, because I broke this down into A, B, C. What it was like, that's part A. What happened, that's part B. And what it's like now, that's part C. So I'm still on part B about what happened. Somewhere in going to all these meetings and getting to know people, I started to identify. I kind of, the way that I come to understand things is subconsciously, but sometimes it becomes very black and white to me. I realized either I get involved with this thing and get serious about it, or I'm not going to stick around. So that's why I said yes to some of these service positions. I also realized from listening to people's stories, like it says in the big book, and I think Tim read at the beginning, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. At some point, I realized that my life was really a mess, and I had a chance at being happy, joyous, and free. I heard these things, and they were attractive to me. I wasn't quite sure how to get them, but it was suggested that I get a sponsor. So I asked several women that I met at different meetings if they would sponsor me. And I got a lot of rejections, and I tried not to take it personally. And then someone finally relented, and she said, okay, I'll be your sponsor. And she was my sponsor for like 20 years. And such a sweet lady, Cindy M. She's passed away now too, Cindy Mosher. Her family moved her away because of health reasons, and she passed away last year, I believe. I lose track of time sometimes. It might have been 2 years ago, but very sweet. She gave me so much of her time, very selfless. And then I had the privilege, as she was older and she wasn't able to drive, and she was living in a retirement apartment, to go pick her up and bring her to meetings sometimes. And that was a joy to me. So that's part of my story, is service work. And of course, as an alcoholic, I was selfish. I didn't really care. Oh, I forgot the part about when my mom, I just realized this recently. My mom gave me a gas card to go to Texaco, I think it was, when I was a teenager. And I just thought that was, you know, carte blanche to go in there. I realized that Texaco sold beer, and Texaco sold cigarettes, and Texaco sold Doritos and anything. And so I don't know how many hundreds of dollars I ran up. I had no responsibility. I just didn't understand about that. And I probably need to make some financial amends for that, if my mom remembers how much I charged up on her Texaco card in 1987. So I got to AA and I realized, yes, I'm one of them. I must have this thing. And I got involved in service work. And that's one of the things that, like I said, it's been so very important to me. So about 1995 is when the Deaf Sober Group was started. And there was a man named Mike Kerbo. He's also passed away. And he was such a sweet person. I have met some of the most wonderful people in AA. He was totally devoted to service. That was his gig. And whenever I saw him, he was doing some service. He cooked meals at NABA. He hung out. He was instrumental in starting that Deaf Sober Group. One Sunday afternoon, I was just hanging out, I guess, after the beginner's meeting, and he said, why don't you come to the Deaf Sober Group? And it was in American Sign Language. I had no experience with American Sign Language, didn't really know any deaf people growing up. Interestingly, I realized later, my great uncle had been the superintendent of the New York School for the Deaf, like in the 60s, 70s, and he had visited us, and, you know, he was signing with a little girl at church, and that was pretty cool to see. But I didn't have a lot of experience with deaf folks, so I showed up, and they were having some little classes before the meeting, and I learned my ABCs and how to say hi, my name is, and I just kept going to the meeting for a long time with an interpreter there. And I never really bothered to learn too much sign language. I learned some pretty cool signs that I found out later when I did go for formal training, were not used in polite conversation. And they wondered how I knew some of these things. Like, in basic ASL 101, we were learning our ABCs, 1, 2, 3s, all of that. And then we were learning the verbs, like how to show to eat, to read, to sleep. And I got to drink. And I thought, oh, great, I know that sign. And I did the sign, which is this. It's like a beer stein. Now, this means drink alcoholically, like with two hands, really drinking alcoholically. And that's how I learned the sign to drink, from going to the deaf sober meeting. And the teacher in the class was like, whoa, what are you doing? This is like to drink like a normal person. Like you're drinking from a cup, very sedately. And so that's when they thought, there's something wrong with this girl. But I went through it. I went to school. I went to ASL 1, 2, 3, 4. And I actually went into a 2-year training program for sign language interpreting. Sign language interpreting is a very difficult profession. I learned that I'm just not fit. My personality is not a good fit. But I do sign, and I can sign enough to communicate in the deaf sober group, and that was what was important to me. That was my goal. And I have the utmost admiration, I'm looking at Lou right now, the utmost admiration for sign language interpreters, especially sign language interpreters who are coming to AA meetings, NA meetings. I mean, there's not a lot of money in it when you're coming to an AA meeting. Most of them do it out of the kindness of their heart. To carry the message to, you know, a deaf or hard of hearing alcoholic who, you know, wants to get the message of recovery and wants to get sober. So I became really involved with the Deaf Sober group. We're small but mighty. We still meet every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at the NABA Club. We're meeting on Zoom. We've been meeting on Zoom for a year. And that works out great because we can gather people from all over the country. My experience, besides the service work, and I'll get into a little bit more of that too, is with the steps. When I came into AA, I feel like I was fairly agnostic. And I wondered, why did God let bad things happen? You know, I was like very metaphysical, all very, very deep, trying to understand God. And I realized that I didn't have to try to figure everything out. You know, over the years, I've learned I don't have to try to figure everything out. AA tells me that. I went to a big book study fairly early on Friday nights, and there was somebody there named John Eric. I think he was a Dutch guy. And he had like 20 years sober at the time. I thought he was just, you know, the guru. And he said, it doesn't matter what your concept of a higher power is, that's the correct one. And I still remember that. That was a really long time ago. Recently, I was reading the Living Sober book, and it was referring back to the big book when Ebby said to Bill, why don't you choose your own conception of God? That helped me a lot. I've also learned that I live my life by spiritual principles. Sometimes I have to refer back to these. There's these little cards, you know, that I've seen made up. These 12-step principles are not official in the big book or anything anywhere. I have kind of this set of goals now I can work towards. Honesty, courage, integrity, willingness, humility. And I'll get shortly, just quickly to the story. A couple, you know, pain and sorrow happens. And whether you're sober or not, pain and sorrow will happen. And I've had, you know, some. It talks in the big book about the certain low spots. It doesn't say, like, if they happen. It's talking about when they happen. So, yes, a couple of things, and AA helped me through these things. In 2005, I had become pregnant, and we wanted to have a child. And we ended up losing that pregnancy, and that was hard. And you know what? The first thing I did after I left the hospital, after I had the medical procedure that they needed to do on me, I went to an AA meeting. So it just wasn't in the cards for us to have kids, I guess. Oh, I found my husband in AA. That's a good thing. And we got married in 1998. We've been married 23 years. Anyway, AA has always been there for me. And in 2008, I was having some physical issues, And I went to several different doctors, and eventually it turned out that I had stage 3 colon cancer. And that was in 2008. So I was 42 years old. I'm like, what's up with this? And when I was in the little room where they tell you, you know, the doctor said, hey, you know, there's a tumor and it's 90% blocking your colon and we think it's cancerous, but we're going to let the people that read the x-rays, whatever they're called, radiation technologists, those people, read it and tell us officially. And my husband kind of had a little moment there. And being from a different generation, he's a little older than I am. And when you hear the cancer word, you're just, I mean, it's bad. But for me, this is how the program has worked in my life. I can only tell you, because I've been going AA for a really long time. The first thing I thought of was, what can I do about this? What action can I take? And I trusted my doctor completely. And I've had a good outcome, obviously. That was not me. Because on a normal basis, I worry about every little thing. But this was a huge thing, and I was able to handle it. And it was only through the program, it's only through me developing a relationship with my higher power. I can't, you know, tell my story and not explain that. Because when I came in, I really didn't want anything to do with the higher power. But at some point along the line, I got that relationship with the higher power. And I knew when I was going through cancer, everything was going to be okay, no matter what. And I didn't know what the future held. I knew I had to have surgery. I knew I went through 6 months of chemo. My doctor was very, very, I feel, compassionate. He was direct and he was funny, and his bedside manner was pretty hysterical. Doctors can be weird, but he, I trusted him. He didn't tell me what the prognosis is for my particular, you know, stage and all of that until after I'd gone through the chemo. And he said, well, you know, I just wanted to be sure there weren't any rogue cells out there, but we got the cancer when we did the surgery. At that point, I was like, you mean I went through all of that, you know, all that chemo, just, another funny thing that happened when I was going through cancer is, a surgeon came to my bedside. Oh, well, let me get back. So I ended up in the hospital. It was a Friday afternoon, and I called my parents, and they were up here the very next day, the very next morning. And the colorectal surgeon came to my bedside, and she was a small Chinese-American woman, and she said to me, I have the smallest hands on the colorectal surgical staff. And I thought, oh, how wonderful for you. I really thought that was a strange way to introduce yourself. But I found out later that if you're a colorectal surgeon, it's good to have small hands because you're in there in people's intestines and stuff. So she was a really funny person, and she told me that she deals with butts and guts. That was her job. So a bunch of people from AA showed up, and they were downstairs waiting for me to have a meeting. And she came in. My parents arrived just at the right exact time to hear all the stuff the surgeon had to say and all their plans and stuff. So, but I'm like, I need to get downstairs. There's people waiting for me to have a meeting. And, so I end up in the elevator with this, the colorectal surgeon who has the smallest, hands on the team. And she just turned to me, it was just me and her. And she said, you must be mortified, talking about, you know, what I'm going through and being, diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer at a young age and ended up in the hospital and facing surgery and all that. And I said to her, I said, no. I said, I am in recovery. I have a 12-step program. I have a higher power. I have a sponsor. And I have sponsorees. That helped me get through. You know, a lot of people showed up. There were people who sat with me when I was taking chemo in the chemo chair. I actually told my story one time because I had the little pump I had to wear. I went for the treatments, and then I had to wear the pump, and then I'd go back and drop the pump off, and then I got to have like a week of feeling sick, and then I'd start feeling better. Then I'd have to get the treatment again and go home with the pump. But they wanted me to tell my story, and I had the pump. And I was up there at the podium with Toco Group, I think, And I thought, this is just the weirdest thing ever. Here I am actually getting all this poison put into my body, and I'm up here telling my story in AA. So I see that I need to wind up here in a minute or two, but I did want to just say how important it was for me to get into service and to become involved with the Deaf Sober Group. I've been involved with accessibilities. It used to be called special needs. I was able to be at the international convention, and they had an awesome speaker here in Atlanta, 2015. He was in the Georgia Dome, and he was a deaf man up there on the stage in front of 60,000 people. That was really touching. I've had such incredible experiences in AA. I've met so many cool people. I see a lot of people here tonight who are supporting me, and I thank you. That's about all I have to say. One other thing is that, and I'm paraphrasing this from the big book, but in talking about my cancer story, which is just a little small part of my story now. At the time, it was huge. At the time, it was really awful. But now I can just go back, oh, yeah, I had cancer. But this program has allowed me to meet calamity with serenity. And I read that in the big book early on, and I thought, what the does that mean? What does that even mean? And then I realized I saw people meeting calamity with serenity. I saw Bob Meadows, who had a brain tumor, and he actually had staples in his head, and he was coming to AA meetings. And I learned from people like that. You know, I've learned, and I stand on the shoulders of giants. I've heard people say that, and I really believe that's true. Because when we come in here and we share our experience, strength, and hope, you never know who you might help. You just never know. And I've been to a lot of speaker meetings, and I've gotten a lot from them. I hope that maybe you guys got a little tiny bit of something from my story today. Thanks for being here. I'm finished.
Thank you, Carrie.
Great job, Carrie.
And what a great story. And I remember a lot of what you discussed, and learned some new stuff about you. And yeah, Bob Meadows, wow, what a warrior. What a spiritual giant Bob Meadows was. Julie is going to give out the chips.
I'm Julie, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Carrie, that was fantastic. I love getting to know you better. I really do it. And, you know, what a story, and I'm so glad that I was here to hear it. Here at the Blue Chip Speakers meeting on Zoom, we have a chip system to mark our time in sobriety. We have a white chip for anybody who's coming in for the first time or after some experimentation. If you would like a white chip, let us know. Don't forget to unmute yourself. We have a silver chip for 30 days. Does anyone have 30 days?
I have 30 days.
Oh, Lisa's got 30 days. Yay.
Oh, Lisa, great.
Way to go.
Yes.
Time flies.
Yeah.
Well done. Well done.
Thank you.
Anybody else for 30 days? How about 90 days?
This is John, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd love a 90-day chip.
Yeah. All right.
Chip day. I'm having some chips.
Cool. Right.
Wow.
Woo-hoo-hoo. Oh, man. Neat.
How about yellow for 6 months?
Anybody have six months?
All right. Green chip for 9 months. Well, it is a very special day for me because I have the privilege of doing two things that are going to make me very happy. You know, you stay sober long enough, you make friends in AA, and you watch people grow and change and serve and do all the things that people do. And so I get the privilege of giving our friend Tim Ridgway his chip today, who, if you don't, no, Tim, you just don't understand how much work he puts into the AA program and how much he loves it, and how much he loves all of us, and what a good spirited human being he is. So I am, once again, echoing. So here you are, Tim. Here's your chip. Love you, man.
Thank you, Julie. And this is 14. And I tell you...
Woo!
Tinsley is celebrating tonight. That I think everybody already knew that. But I want to tell you, I wasn't so sure about this program, if it was the right thing. But, you know, I made a compromise. I hadn't surrendered. I was willing to give it a try. And I think the second week I was at NAVA, I see a poster, and it says Tinsley E. He's telling his story at the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting. And I was just, everybody I saw said, Tinsley E., is that like, you know, they're saying it's an anonymous program. I can't tell you. So I showed up, and there he was, and I was like, oh, my God. What? This is incredible. And then he tells this story that I could fully relate to. And I was like, you know, this might be a lot of fun. And I guess I've felt like that ever since. So thank you, Tinsley. Happy birthday to you.
All right, Tim, thank you. All right, so that is my second privilege, is to give my chip to my dearest friend in the world and certainly my AA compatriot. And, you know, it's interesting, Carrie, that in your story that you touched to the end about the certain low spots. It has been a hell of a year for all of us, but some of us have had a worse year than others. But there's something I can attest to, and that is that my friend Tinsley Ellis, his cornerstone is in place, and he has an unshakable foundation for life. And I am very privileged to give you your 22, your chip. There you are. You're below me here. Take it. Thank you.
Hey, thanks. My name is Tinsley. I'm a alcoholic, and thank you for the kind words, Tim. And I would just like to thank you, Tim, for all of the service you do for us at this meeting and for AA in general. It does not go unnoticed, and it should not go unthanked. And thank you for the kind words, Julie, very much. Yeah, it's been a rough year for me. Losing my son to this disease, and it's only because this fellowship and this program and my higher power held me up and shielded me from a drink or a drug. Not once did I think about it, and that is a miracle to me. And I won't lie to you, it was very difficult, and it's going to be difficult for a long time. But Carrie, thank you for your story, and you mentioned matching calamity with serenity. And that is certainly what this program has done to me. And it allowed me to also along the way to grow my higher power. I came in as an agnostic, and now I'm a believer. This is a miraculous program, and I love y'all very much. Thank you.
First I slipped, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. I look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. I always long for something that set me free. Take me where the promise is.